This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Armand Childers, and I have the great pleasure of hosting Irvin Malachi today. Welcome to the New Books Network, Irvin.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Thanks for being here. Before we jump into your wonderful book, can you tell us a bit about yourself?
Absolutely. I'm an assistant professor. No, I'm sorry, an associate. As recently an associate professor of studies at the University of British Columbia. And I'm also the director of the Center for European Studies here at the university. And my area of studies, research and teaching entails queer studies, German studies, and I focus on media histories anywhere from the sort of late 18th to century to today.
And I mean, your book also brings all of these areas together in a wonderful and creative way. Can you tell us, your book is called Andas as the Andan, and it came out of McGill Queen's University Press this year, right? In 2023. How did your path cross with the film Andas as the Andan? And maybe like for those of us who don't know, can you tell us a bit about the film itself?
I'd be glad to. So I talk a little bit about the history of my personal history with regard to the film and introduction of the book. So I'm very excited that you are also asking about this. I encountered this film as a graduate student in a PhD program in German studies in a class on Weimar cinema. The film itself was not taught there, but I was doing a little bit of research on another very famous film from the era, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. And in some of the readings about Caligari, in particular, Konrad Veit, one of the main sort of performers and very famous performance in a film, I encountered a mention of this film. So it was described as the first film on homosexual rights in this German context. And I believe actually that reference also made it sound like it was the first gay movie ever made. And it turned out that's actually not true at all. But the reference itself made me absolutely curious. As a queer scholar, a person interested in German cinema history, I absolutely became drawn to it. Having said that, I ended up not doing much work on that film in that course, nor have I really encountered much information about it since in my professional path. And very, very much later, sort of in my second or third year as a faculty member, I started pursuing queer studies more seriously and wanted to pick up this film, which was something that I'd always sort of thought of fondly, and I also taught in a lot of the courses that I had a privilege to teach, and that's kind of what brought me onto this sort of like idea of writing an entire book on a topic, in particular try to activate it for an audience, summarize some of the scholarship on it, but also advance some of my own theses about it, make it accessible for an audience who might know The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, but who might not be familiar with Andas als die Andan. So I wanted to kind of bring this film into the foreground much more than it has been in the past.
And I mean, maybe for those of us who don't know much about the film, the plot or anything, like what makes this film special?
So the film itself was conceived as There are two sort of like underlying bigger projects for the film. On the one hand, it was conceived as a pop culture melodrama. It was made for the masses, but at the same time, it was informed by the work and an advocacy of the very famous sexologist Magnus Hirschfeld, who is listed as a co-conspirator behind the project alongside the director Richard Oswald. And so one of the things that that Hirschfeld wanted to accomplish is popularize some of his theses and some of his work in seeking to abolish paragraph 175 of the German Penal Code, which criminalized male homosexuality. So there was a decided interest in a political mission that this film advanced, and it was in a service of kind of like trying to take down this legal code that variously suppressed the lives of many queer men. And the plot itself, however, so interestingly enough, the film was not a documentary. Very early on, some of the people who were making similar films such as this, the so-called Aufklärungsfilme or Enlightenment films or social hygiene films, which are a device to kind of like advance a particular kind of social mission or social reform and bring about social reform, realized that documentary formats were too boring. And they were not necessarily interesting for the masses. And so they were like, oh, well, how can we advance film in this sort of social reform way if it's so boring for the masses? And so they're like, oh, just wrap it in a melodramatic plot line and everyone will want to watch the movie. They were not wrong. This film and others like it absolutely drew audiences. And one of the ways that the melodramatic plot unfolds is that there is a main character who's an established violinist, who's a kind of like a respectable upper middle class citizen, who's a queer individual and who falls in love with one of his proteges. They have a beautiful romance together until they're discovered by a blackmailer who uses paragraph 175 as a way to extort money from them. And so the melodramatic plot line develops from there, and it ends in a very tragic death of the suicide of the protagonist. And the sort of like political mission, Hirschfeld himself plays a role in the film. Hirschfeld kind of intervenes at strategic points of the film in order to enlighten the masses. And so the despair at the end of the film was mobilized by Hirschfeld as a sort of means by which to kind of enlighten the audiences watching this film who might be feeling sad for the fate of the protagonist and tell them, listen, there's something you can do about it. Help me abolish paragraph 175. So there's a decided sort of pedagogical mission behind the film.
And I mean, like the films, I did watch kind of an illicit version of the film before reading your book online, and I mean it needed a lot of restoration, right, because of what happened to the film. Can you talk a bit about that history as well?
I want to do a justice where it's needed. So there's a couple of institutions and individuals who are doing some remarkable work around it. And first and foremost, the Film Museum in München has been advancing very important and has been doing that restoration work and has been introducing the film on DVD versions. Now I believe in its fourth edition available that was published made available just last year in a really crisp, gorgeous new sort of digital like restoration. And then James Steak has been an incredibly important historian of that sort of like censorship history, but also on the sort of material history of this film. And so I wanted to kind of pay that homage to these, on the one hand, this incredible institution, and on one hand to James, who's just been doing such incredible work for the last decades with regard to homosexual rights history in Germany, but also specifically to the film. With regard to the history of the print itself, so the film itself was made at a time of relative relaxation of censorship in the German context. And so it was actually introduced on the market at a time when censorship had been abolished. Like one of the promises of the new constitution during the Weimar Republic was that it forbade censorship. And a lot of the cultural practitioners who previously experienced suppression in various ways, especially under imperial and monarchical sort of discourses, were able to do things that they were not able to do before. before. It did not last long, however. So basically, by 1920, you have the reintroduction of the first censorship clause, and in no small part because of cinema. And so the cinema becomes the sort of first attempt to, and actually a realized attempt to introduce censorship into the public. And so Anders als die anderen was one of the films that was absolutely banned for public screenings. It was only authorized to be screened for professionals, which radically reduced its audience. Up until later in the 1920s, when Hirschfeld and Ostwald came together again, in particular, Hirschfeld, who wanted to repurpose some of the material for another project of his, cuts up the film, makes it into an episode alongside others on sexual practices in the 1920s. That film too gets subjected to censorship. And the episode that is comprised of the material from Anders als die anderen actually is the only one that's censored from it and has to be taken out. However, before this happens, the material for this travels. And is sent in different contexts throughout East Europe, and especially in a Soviet context. And this small little chopped up episode, of which there is about 28 minutes of runtime, makes it somehow from over St. Petersburg down to Kiev, and there gets sort of subjected to censorship too. It gets transformed into another type of film, right after World War II, there was sort of like new ways that film travels back to the German context, in particular via some of the sort of like Soviet connections, comes back to the GDR context, and from there gets exposed to new audiences through homosexual rights organizing networks, slowly moves its way into the hands of some of the restoration people at the Film Museum München, who end up doing some of the sort of like recovery work and making it available for today. So today we have this fragment of about 28 minutes of runtime that is supplemented with archival material that was including promotional stills, but also some of the material from Hirschfeld's archive that basically comprises about 51 minutes of runtime of a movie that was initially at least double that time.
And I mean, one of the things I liked about the book is that you start by kind of unfolding the conditions of possibility of this film in the early Weimar Republic and through the work of Richard Oswald. Richard, I guess. Can you tell us a bit about that as well?
So, I'll start with that question and maybe take it a little bit out of a different direction, because I'm one of the interests that I had with this film was so it's been written about before. It's not like scholars have not written about this film before. I'm very grateful for these studies. I myself published an article on the film long before I would pursue the research on the book. However, when people usually wrote about this text, they always situated it in the history, first and foremost, in the history of the early homosexual rights movement in Germany, which is a really important context for the film. However, when you do that, there's a sort of a little bit of a sort of tendency that results from it, which is that the film kind of emerges as exclusively an artifact of the early homosexual rights movement. It becomes a sort of like political text and a tractat of sorts, like a political program. And it almost then changes form again in this reception history of it. And so one of the things that I was really interested in is centering the film in Richard Oswald's and his sort of like production company, his sort of like positionality on the German pop culture market at the time. He was a pop culture wizard. Like, he absolutely was intrigued by the capacities of the popular cinema, shaped the development of multiple popular genres at the time, and was really interested in turning to this film, I think, first and foremost, as a melodrama. And so one of the things that I was trying to do in sort of like turning to Richard Oswald, centering this film as a melodrama first and foremost, is not to negate the context of the early homosexual rights rights movement, which is an absolutely important context for it, but also kind of hold space, a substantial amount of space for the fact that most people who went to see this movie did not go to see it because it was part of the early homosexual rights movement, but because it was a melodrama with an extremely appealing storyline and because it was on a scandalous topic matter. So people actually went to see this movie for that, not necessarily for the homosexual rights activism that underpins it, although that's an incredibly important component of it.
And I mean, the genre of melodrama itself does important work for your argument in the book. Can you tell us a bit about that as well?
Absolutely. Thank you so much. So one of the things that I hope I didn't do with the book is sort of critique a little too much the potentials that Hirschfeld saw in cinema for the dissemination of his activist and scholarly work with regard to homosexual rights advocacy. I think the film absolutely conveys quite a lot of information and is aligned with his broader sort of interests to popularize the activism that he was doing and make people inform the public, enlighten the public about lives of queer people and the sort of rights that need to be in place in order for those queer people to have access to living the same way that their non-queer counterparts have. But to me, there was an unpersuasive and also a really kind of neglectful political mission with regard to how film operates and how viewership cultures, in particular those of viewers who are attuned to the genre of the melodrama, would kind of engage with the film. And one of the ways that I was trying to sort of interact with Hirschfeld is just, of course, hold on to the context and then gently move away from it and step a little bit into the direction of early film theory and scholarship on melodrama and its sort of like audience's effect, an effect it has on audiences, by a way to articulate a potentially different kind of political potentiality for the film that lies in the mournful imagery that the film presents viewers. One of the things that I try to argue is that the severe sadness of the storyline stifles political co-optation. And one of the things that Hirschfeld was trying to do is to say, listen, there's this really sad thing. There's this queer corpse that's introduced at the end of the film. He wanted to rehabilitate that corpse and make it have a political valence and use the sort of like sadness of that moment to basically inspire his audiences to join his movement. As admirable as that is, I think that sort of makes an assumption about the capacities of viewers, in particular with regard to sad imagery. And one of the things that I'm trying to do in the film is to basically sit with this sadness, in particular this sort of mournfulness that the film introduces, and retrace the mournfulness on the basis of a sort of over 100-year reception history of the film, where viewers absolutely articulated their sort of severe depressive relationship with regard to the subject matter that stands in contradiction to the political potentialities that Hirschfeld wanted to make available for the film. But this isn't to say that there isn't a politic in that. It's just that that politic might require a little bit of a different articulation. And one of the ways that I try to activate that is through film theory, in particular through discourses on mourning and what mourning can actually bring about. So for me, the sort of sadness of the film facilitates an intergenerational, cross-cultural, trans-historic mourning and brings about an awareness of the long struggle that attends queer life that helps us maybe move in a little bit of a more honest direction with regard to our own relationship to queer progress in our moment today. So for me, that that sort of potentiality for politics is absolutely in this film. It just, it takes on a little bit of a different valence with regard to maybe the way that Hirschfeld would have liked it to see unfold.
And I guess that also kind of stems from the tension between melodrama and Aufklärungsfilm, or like social hygiene film, like the way kind of that, the way, I mean, I guess like this, the tension between the aesthetics of the film versus the kind of didactics of it. And you also, I mean, to kind of talk about the how the film kind of does what it does in terms of engaging the audiences with the like these sad feelings, as you say. You also talk about like embodiment and gesture and kind of the cinematic intimacy. Can you tell us a bit about that as well?
I would love to. I think this is an incredibly important component of it. It is true that the film presents what Richard Dyer in his work on it would call, you know, there are two components to it. There's a sad love story, and then there's a lecture. And that lecture is Hirschfeld's sort of didacticism. And there is literally like Hirschfeld plays a character, a sort of like sexologist, a physician who kind of enlightens an audience about the sort of intricacies of queer life. But the love story and the sort of melodramatic dimension of it takes up quite a lot of space of this film. And that space is replete with a very kind of gentle unfolding of a main character's sort of relationship to queer life that starts out with initially a sort of very mournful moment whereby the character reads newspaper announcements about suicides of very established, respectable gays, as they say. Sorry, they were not in the newspaper articles, they were not mentioned as gays, but like very respectable figures, right? And there is a sort of moment of realization of this character kind of putting one and one together. So like the newspapers, like, oh, we don't, one of the articles is like, oh, we don't know why somebody with this stature would want to take his own life. And Kerner, the protagonist, the violinist, the main character of the film, puts one and one together, and he's absolutely sees the connection. So there's a sort of like announcement of this like really sad storyline already in the opening, but very quickly we transition into this kind of happy relationship that he enters with one of his proteges. But that serves a very particular function in a film, which is to kind of set up some of the mournful, sad imagery that comes right thereafter, because the sort of happiness and excitement of this new romance, this gay romance on screen, doesn't last long because the social structures that variously burden queer life at the time slowly make themselves available. And under the sort of like pressure of these social structures, this protagonist's disposition it registers on the body. And so there is this sort of like actual sort of like physical manifestation of some of this pain of navigating the public life as a queer person of the time that variously shapes how this character carries himself in public, but also how he interacts with all of this information. And so one of the things that I do in the book is I try to retrace through these sort of complicated embodiment structures and performance styles of Konrad Veit, who plays Kerner, the main protagonist. I try to recreate the crumbling, the sort of like slowly dissolving body, mind of the protagonist under the pressures of an anti-queer hetero patriarchy. To me, this absolutely registers in the pain of the body. And therein lies that sort of like deep engagement process of melodrama too, because it gives you access to these impossible struggles that characters face. And you are supposed to, as a viewer, somehow interact with that. And usually that interaction runs via recourse to emotion and a sentimentality. And these kind of like structures of sentimentality are very, very, very important for the understanding of the film's broader sort of aesthetic operations.
And I mean, that I guess also brings us to the question of, I mean, sad feelings, but also using Heather Love's term, feeling backwards. We already talked about it a little bit, but like, what does this do Like, what is the, I mean, you put it very nicely, like, what's the political use of the corpse? What's the use of feeling backwards in relation to and as the Andan?
I am a huge fan of Heather Love's work, and I'm very, very grateful for it. It has, it, to me, been a really sort of not just a means to understand my own sort of like scholarly interests better, but as a queer person, I find some sort of comfort in the brutal honesty of the work that book in particular advances. And so one of the main ideas within it is that, say, in the sort of popular queer imagination, like the popular queer imagination of our sort of like neoliberal North American present, queer optimism and queer progress are incredibly important affective structures that underpin whatever might be characterized as a queer rights movement, in particular in the aftermath of gay marriage, etc. Right. And there is a sort of tendency that the sort of the attainment of rights is a negation of anti-queerness, meaning that by reaching certain rights, queer people are no longer discriminated against, which is, as we know, absolutely not true. But there is a sort of tendency to valorize progress and the affective structures of progress, which are all in the realm of the positive, and kind of viewed suspiciously negativity and negative affect. So people who are depressed apparently are not part of sort of like progressivist queer organizing, right? Because they're downers, right? Like and negative affect is, as a sort of depressive force, not a really good thing through which to organize. I mean, through negative affective theories, which have been so incredibly important for me, including the work of Heather Love and others, you realize that that's just absolutely not true, right? That there is actually quite a lot of great political potential within negativity. And that usually in Heather, so for instance, in Heather Love's conception, one of the sort of notions of feeling backward, which is the sort of like turning to things like melancholia, turning to feelings of depression and sadness and shame and these kinds of like structures of feeling that are absolutely part and parcel of the queer affective archive today and historically, can be incredibly liberating, in particular because we might be sort of like activating for ourselves a venue to participate in contemporary queer discourses. If you are like me, a person who is sort of chronic melancholic, you know, like you're absolutely able to see valence in that. And for her work, this means that the sort of queer negativity, in particular sort of structures of mourning, could actually be a means by which to ha nurture a more honest relationship to our present, so that through kind of like activating and taking serious affective negativity, you're able to see that the world is still an unhappy and a deeply dangerous place for queer people today. And so for me, one of the things that this film does, and one of the way theses that I advance in the book, is that watching Anders als die Andern today is a sort of practice of feeling backward and turning to this artifact of sadness and mourning. An artifact of sadness that facilitates mourning today is a means by which we can be reminded of the long struggle for queer rights, but not just queer rights, but that there is this sort of like long journey ahead of us yet to go to reach what we could call queer liberation, which in my perspective has not been reached, especially if you think about queer life on a planetary scale. If you think of queer life in a way that attempts to racializing class struggles that variously inform and still kind of shape queer life today, that the world is indeed in some of the most, quote, progressive, end quote, spaces, still a dangerous world for some queer people. And so I feel like watching Andal Salstiandan actually reminds us of that in our most delusional moments of optimism. These sad movies are precisely serving that political function for us as a reminder to keep that struggle strong.
I mean, let's, I guess, end on this powerful note. But before we end, I'm also curious what you're working on right now. What's the next project?
Oh, thank you so much. I'm working on a couple of projects. I'm positioning myself as a queer studies person with interest in media studies, but there's a personal project and then there's an academic project. And I mean, to me, those are always both, but in a neoliberal academic landscape, you almost sometimes need these markers. So I want to tell you about the personal project first, because I'm very intrigued by this. I was born in former Yugoslavia in what is today Bosnia, and I was born in a Muslim family and grew up in what I like to call the queer Bosnian diaspora. But what that queer Bosnian diaspora is not necessarily, like, you know, there are no handbooks for that. There's no guides for that. There's no, like, how to, you know, like, there. I mean, Google it, you'll find very little information about it, right? And this isn't to say it doesn't exist, right? It's just that the cultural practices of it have been such in this complicated world, whereby on the one hand, the queer Bosnian diaspora practitioners, if you want to call them, use methods that are not interesting in the archive as we valorize it in a sort of academic context. At the same time, I want to hold space that there have been sort of like hostile structures which have been suppressing the development of this archive in a public way. So I am actually trying to work in both of these arenas at the same time. So I'm writing a book of personal essays. It's called Tetka Theory, A Queer Life in a Bosnian Diaspora, which is based on my own sort of lived experience, in which I retrace my family's and my personal lived experience from Yugoslavia, the refugee migration route to Germany, and my sort of subsequent migration to the North American context, and try to articulate different sides of affect and resource making for people such as myself, and make them available in a hopefully humorous, at times also extremely depressive way. So in a very sort of playful format of whereby each chapter kind of takes on the form of like sitting down over a cup of coffee and cigarettes with your aunties and chatting about some of the things that are going on in your life. So that's one project. I'm very, very excited about that. And I was very curious to note that a bunch of sort of scholarly and other organizations were willing to fund it. To be quite honest, I was very surprised by that. And I'm very grateful for that, but also very surprised by that. And then the other project is I'm pursuing a more scholarly project, which might be inappropriately perceived as a sort of stab against sexology again. I'm interested in the occult and a media history and a media theory of the occult, in particular as it intersects with queer studies. The usual sort of like Foucauldian inspired sort of narrative of the history of sexuality is, you know, the homosexual, the idea of the homosexual was born in a clinic, or, you know, there's that sort of like famous like notion that variously gets to be, I think, still very much staged and informed. A lot of the scholarship on the history of sexology absolutely centers that, you know, the birth of the homosexual. They're like, you know, so like, you know, before Magnus Hirschfeld, no one knew how to call it. Like, no, there were no queer people or something like that. You know what I mean? Like these sort of like impulses. I don't think those scholars would actively ever say something like that, but like there is this sort of like move to kind of like allocate to sexology a really kind of prominent place in a history of sexuality. And by turning to the occult, I'm trying to showcase that there were absolutely much more different and much more complicated and much more diffuse and democratic means by which people were making knowledge about queerness and their queer lives through things like tarot card readings, coffee ground culture, you know, like esoteric practices, which were ironically not esoteric, you know, in the sense of that we're not just reserved for select few people, but they were actually available to many, many, many people If you didn't have education and resources to read das Jahrbuch für sexuelle Zwischenstufen, you most certainly had enough money to go get your tarot cards read. You know, so I'm trying to kind of shift the focus away a little bit, but also just make available this extremely complicated world of knowledge making that lies within these structures of the of what I think commonly we would call the occult, but they're much more complicated than that. So that's my new sort of bigger project, a big book project on a media theory and of the occult, a queer media theory of the occult.
I mean, as a tarot reader I work also on German spirituality at the moment. I really, really look forward to reading this next book as well. Thank you so much, Erwin, for joining us today.
Thanks so much. I appreciate you. It was a pleasure.